Hank, and come back with us next week or the week after and let us know what you discovered, how well it's going. Doug, Doug, to meet you at SAY in Rocky Point. Hope we haven't put you to sleep. Keep your eyes up. You've got it, Doug.
U-H-O-S-A-Y in Rocky Point. I wasn't going to get involved with that, but every electret microphone I've ever seen has got a transistor in it someplace to amplify the output, which is a zillion ohms or thereabouts of the element. So if I was looking at that thing, I would look for the amplifying device, the transistor, usually it's a FET, and see whether that's working or not. Anyway, that's not what I was here about. Couple of things. Last week, you steered me to 60 Minutes with a story about possible RF attacks on embassy personnel in places like China and Cuba. And I was wondering whether it's really RF. Maybe it's subsonic. I have read anyway, that there is a lot of problems with really subsonic sounds. Something like 50 hertz or so, or maybe lower than that, maybe 10 hertz, which can disrupt a biological element like a brain or an animal or something. So I was wondering whether that could be something we could look at. I had one other thing I wanted to mention, but we'll wait for that until I get to this one.
You've got a very good point there, Doug. And I don't think they mentioned that, or at least they didn't make it clear in the program. So very strong amounts of subsonic and ultrasonic. Multiple signals at ultrasonic frequencies like 21 kc and 21.5 kc, 21.05 kc, so to speak, at real high power. You wouldn't hear the direct ultrasonic signal, but the beating between the two could give you some weird effects. So, subsonic or ultrasonic, multiple signals of high amplitude, in my opinion, that's a possible causative agent that should be investigated. If you were using a radio field strength meter, you wouldn't see anything. You need some kind of a broadband acoustic sensing device into an oscilloscope to see if there's anything there, oscilloscope or spectrum analyzer. I'm going to pass it back to you, Doug. Drag your feet in case anybody wants to add to that one. But you got a good point. To B2SAY with some delay, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Got it, Dick. Let me see. I got it. They kept talking about RF signals, and it's obvious that anybody dealing with RF at all would just take a special analyzer over there and look at it. But if they're not seeing anything, maybe the spectral analyzer isn't seeing anything in the RF range. So that's what occurred to me. Anyway, thank you for turning me on to that 60 Minutes show. It was very interesting. The other thing I wanted to bring up is very simple. I recently found an advertisement on the internet for something called an atomic lighter. This is a cigarette lighter. And it operates on some sort of RF frequency. I don't know what frequency, because I haven't plugged in my spectrum analyzer to look at it. But it puts a little blue electric arc between two elements. And it's supposed to be part 15, 15 licensed, so it must generate some sort of RF in there. And you press the button on it, and you get two little crossed purple-ish arcs from the two elements. It doesn't use any fuel at all. So I wonder if anybody has seen that, or if anybody has any information on it.
Now, Roy recognized there's a kind of a propane torch that you can buy, where when you press a button, there's a snapping device in there that puts a small hammer across a piezoelectric crystal, and the piezoelectric crystal makes a few kilovolts that arcs across a gap and starts the flame. So there's a kind of piezoelectric spark generator that works with a small hammer-like device. It makes it click every time you press it. It does a beautiful job. Let's see what Roy's going to say about all of the above. AC2GS, K2LIW. You got it, Roy.
Yeah, Dick, I mean, the technique that you're mentioning has been around for a while. It's what fires up a lot of barbecues. One of the first things to go bad on an inexpensive barbecue is the piezoelectric element. You push it in, it goes click, it bangs the piezoelectric, gives a little spark, and starts the gas lights running. But this is a new type of lighter. I have one. They're all over the place. They charge up on USB connections. They're lithium ion batteries, and they have a step-up high voltage supply and small spark gaps. Sometimes it's just two spark gaps, sometimes it's four in a crossover. They're effective as long as you put the thing that you want to light up directly in the path of the very small arc. The arc usually is about 1 to 2 millimeters.
Now, the arc you're driving, that you're deriving, is that used to ignite a flammable gas, or is that to ignite something directly, like a piece of paper? What are you saying here, Roy? Go ahead.
Basically, portable spark. You can, I've handled, I don't think it would be terribly effective to light the paper, but I haven't tried it. But anything that you would stick a match in, this would cause it to burn. I guess in small places, depending upon the type of paper, yeah, you can fire with it as well. So it's just a portable spark in the way I look upon it.
Roy, the portable spark generator you're describing, what is it called, what brand name, how many dollars, where do you buy it? Give us a few words about this. Sounds like you've been familiar with it for some time. You've got it, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a technology that's all over the place. Chinese are making different names, different sizes, different shapes. All you have to do is go on someplace like Amazon and say, you know, a gasless lighter or something along those terms. It's a battery-driven lighter or what have you. They're ubiquitous. They're all over the place at this point.
Fascinating. I haven't heard about this. Another thing you brought to our attention tonight, Doug, the B2SAY. Thank you, K2RIW. You've got it, Doug.
B2SAY. Okay, I think the description is about right. I would say this thing has got to have, when you press the button to turn it on, you get a little course. I don't know if they're arcs or ionized air or what they are, but they warn you not to put your finger in it. It gets hot, and I have lit the gas stove with the thing, you know, without turning on the electric igniter on the gas stove. It lights the gas stove. And, as I say, it passes Mark 15, so there must be some RF in it somewhere. And yes, it must be a battery. There is no fuel or whatsoever in it, it's just a battery. And you charge it up, as the fellow said, from a UHF, a USB connector or a telephone connector or what, a charger or something like that. It's interesting. I don't smoke anymore. I haven't smoked in 40 years. I just bought it because it was interesting. I'll sign off now and WA2SAY will be clear and listening. Over to you, Dick.
Glad you brought that to our attention, Doug. Where did you buy it and what did it cost and what name did they give it to it, Doug? So how many dollars and where did you buy it, Doug? And did you buy it in the last year or so?
I bought it, I don't know, a couple of months ago, and I don't remember where I bought it, where I found it, but it's called Atomic Lighter. It's item number 12217 from somebody. Let me see, maybe it says where it came from. Well, that's obvious. And it's got part number UN3481. So that's all I can tell you. I don't remember where I bought it from.
Okay, it's called the Atomic Lighter. And roughly how many dollars did it cost, Doug? Go ahead.
It was about $7.
Very nice. Sounds like a handy device. And real tricky. Okay, we're going down the list of the people who signed in.
another question.
Go ahead, Wes.
One question and comment. And one comment. The question. It was a question statement. I don't see any possible way ever for electromagnetic waves to be causing the symptoms experienced by diplomats, American diplomats in Cuba. It must be longitudinal wave with ultrasonic sound. Do you agree with that or not? And to agree.
You might be right. There is a high power RF 94 gigahertz machine sent by the military. We've seen some YouTube videos on it. And at ranges like 100 yards, it can make a crowd of people feel very uncomfortable by local heating of the skin, which is very different than, in other words, the symptoms that the people exposed to that military device, their symptoms are very different than the symptoms of these diplomats. So you might be right. Back to you, Wes.
The second thing is a comment. When Dr. Roy was talking about gamma and X-ray, and you mentioned penetration of the rag, I understood pyramids. X-ray is not used there, cannot penetrate. Gamma cannot penetrate, but neutron. So we have two kinds of neutron. It's the same neutron. It's fast and it's slow. But I believe vocabulary for that explanation would be better if Dr. Roy explains it. Dr. Roy.
The penetration of the pyramid was done with muons. And I think in theory it could have been done with neutrinos also, although detecting neutrinos is so difficult. Muons are difficult to detect, but easier than the neutrinos. But Nova TBS discussion of looking for the other apertures inside of the pyramid were using a series of muon detectors in something like an MRI. They were making a kind of a massive MRI machine. Roy, AC2GS, K2LIW. I presume these muons have got a large penetration capability. Is that true, Roy?
This is neutron.
Yes. To Wesley, these are not neutrons that Dick is talking about. You're talking about thermal neutrons versus hot neutrons. That's just their velocity. If you take something heavy like a neutron and accelerate it to relativistic speed, it has different qualities than if it's just at thermal temperatures and such. So that's neutrons. What Dick was talking about was a case of high-energy muons, which are in the family tree of electrons. They're the next higher up. They're much, much heavier. They're not terribly stable over the long haul, but because they're so massive and small, they can burrow through things, and you can do imaging with them. So they were using muon imaging due to cosmic rays hitting the upper atmosphere atoms and converting the energy of the alpha particles and such into muons, which then showered down on the pyramid and partially got absorbed and partially got transmitted, and so they were able to image through it. Neutrinos, you'd have a problem because nothing would get absorbed. You'd get all the neutrinos at the other end of the pyramid.
I have a problem with that, Dr. Roy. What is depository of muons? And to actually...
I'm not quite sure what you have in terms of a depository. It sounds almost like a bank for muons.
No. Depository could be getting them together in XY pattern on something and creating a map of that what is there. So maybe the wording is unfortunate, but that's what I was asking for. In other words, some form of film that would take that image from you. you have a pyramid of XY size in a vertical pattern. How are you going to do it?
Those muon detectors that they used were a kind of a telescope. The muon detectors that were used had the ability to measure the direction of arrival of the muon waves. That's the impression I got. I'll see if Roy got the same impression. AC2GS, K2RIW.
I wouldn't really call it a wave, although particles have particle-wave duality just as like waves have, but it's more of a particle, and the same way that when neutrinos impact in detectors and give off Cherenkov radiation, you can kind of trace the light and figure out where the thing came from and the direction it that way. There's no really good way of steering muons. You're stuck with the Wobb muons that are being generated above the surface of the Earth there and shining down, and you're using detectors that are capable of detecting the decay of muons into much more stable things, and by tracking the direction of the detection devices, you can infer the direction it came from and develop a sort of a 3D image of what's going on.
And I have a problem again. When you mentioned Cherenkov radiation, that's how you pronounce it, Cherenkov radiation, known as Vilov-Cherenkov radiation. It is electromagnetic radiation emitted when charged particle, let's say electron or whatever the particle, passes through the dielectric medium. I don't see with a speed greater than the phase velocity of light in that medium. I don't see that being applied in this particular place at 2HGS.
I'm pretty sure they did in that article, the PBS special on the subject on NOVA, talk about what I'm calling a telescope, because it was a kind of detector that has the ability to look at the Cherenkov radiation spike that has a direction of arrival indication to it. There was multiple layers to the muon detector.
Repeater, time out.
And when a particle being charged or uncharged, I don't think it has to be charged, but a particle moving faster than the speed of light in that medium of the muon detector gets slowed down, gives off Cherenkov radiation, and the Cherenkov radiation has a direction of arrival indication to it because of the multiple layers, and you look at which layer and XY of each layer saw the Cherenkov radiation. Is that approximately the way I think it works, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
I don't see the electric medium, Dr. Roy.
Doesn't have to be dielectric. Any medium that has a velocity of propagation less than V0 will create Cherenkov radiation from muon waves, I believe. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, I was waiting for the reset. Yeah, I agree with Dick. It's basically traveling faster than the speed of light in that medium. So it would have to have some medium that slows it down, because nothing can travel faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. So you have a medium, it causes an apparent slowness in the velocity of light, but you have a particle that's shooting through there at relatively a faster speed, which produces that type of radiation. And that's my understanding of how many of these imagers tend to rely upon.
When it comes to depth of penetration, I'm guessing pure neutrons, protons, and electrons as particles striking something like the rock of a pyramid, I am guessing that the penetration would be inches. It certainly wouldn't be hundreds of feet that's required to get the three-dimensional pictures they were getting. So I think non-muon particles, neutrons, protons, and electrons, I am guessing they have very little penetration capability by comparison to what they needed for this pyramid imaging. Do you see it that way, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yes, I do, Dick. Beta particles are kind of known to just kind of stop at the outer skin layer. The problem with you could get poisoned by beta emitting material, but you have to ingest it, so it has to be on the surface to have an effect. So these particles don't get very far. They get absorbed or reflected out or in other ways neutralized. Muons are a different thing entirely. Again, they're highly charged, but they're very massive, and they're going really fast.
Did you say muons are highly charged? I'm back to you on that one, Roy.
Okay, that sounds like a little bit too much hyperbole. They're charged particles. They have a plus one charge. So they do have a charge. They are not a neutral particle. They're again, very similar to electrons, if you will. They're electrons' bigger, less stable brother.
If an electron has very little penetration capability, beta ray has very little penetration capability, and a heavier version of an electron, I'm amazed it's got that much penetration capability that it can go through hundreds of feet of rock on a pyramid. A neutrino would have no trouble going through that, and it goes through the whole darn Earth most of the time without hitting anything. But neutrinos require a huge detector, that square kilometer or square mile detector that's in the South Pole region in Antarctica. That's a neutron detector, but a neutrino detector. So the size of the detector required stopped them from using neutrinos, and they use muons instead. Go ahead, Wes. K2RIW.
When you're talking about neutron, fast neutrons, these things could go extremely, extremely far in rocks. And when we talk about pyramids, we're talking about blocks of rocks. And neutron absorption in rocks is strongly influenced by hydrogen content in minerals. And it was found that neutron is extremely efficient in pyramids in Egypt. Let me jump. The way that they were trying to deal with it was hide and seek. So that means you implement variable neutron slower, if I could use this word. You're slowing the neutrons. And you're implementing those in variable in different places. So you put in front of the neutron gun that material, which is a piece of plastic, and then you take it out. And then from the other side, let's say 10, 20 meters, which is 30 feet, 40 feet long way, you have a directional beam of neutrons, you have the same. Now you see the difference, because those neutrons, fast neutrons, will travel and will stop. They will stop from the other side of the wall. In other words, is by comparison between what you see and what you don't see, you're creating a map of XY in vertical pattern. And to explain, Dr. Roy.
Now give us a guess, Roy. Fast or slow neutrons, what's the kind of materials we're talking about? Give us your guess as to how far you think they could penetrate. You've got it, Roy. AC2GS.
Well, again, it depends on how fast you have neutrons. If you are able to accelerate them near relativistic speeds, you can probably penetrate the entire pyramid. You, of course, are required to then have a source of very high velocity neutrons, which is problematic. Muons are sort of always there, so you can take advantage of the average muon shower and such, which is what they did. If you had even a big neutrino detector, as I mentioned before, the problem is you not only need something that will go through the material you want to image, but you want it to go partially through, and the density make a big difference. With neutrinos, the density would be almost meaningless if you had, say, a trillion neutrinos going through the pyramid, if it was solid or if it was empty, you'd probably still get the same trillion neutrinos at the detector. So it wouldn't be great as an imaging technique, but high-energy neutrons probably could be used, but you have to supply your own high-energy neutrons.
I think you're saying cosmic rays do not supply them. Is that true, Roy?
Exactly, because the problem with high-energy neutrons, although they're emitted in space, they have a half-life of 15 minutes. So by the time anything gets here, they've decayed into lesser, more stable things.
Okay, fascinating stuff. And we far from covered this whole subject. I'm looking forward now to the science talk.
Could you for a moment just say about how could you find in any antenna, not only Tesla coil, any antenna, standing wave, being outside, not looking from inside, and to achieve?
Okay. You want to find a standing wave from an antenna external to the antenna. You don't want to use the transmission line. And I didn't say it's easy, but by the law of reciprocity, you could do it. If you had a lot of knowledge about the kind of antenna you're working with, if the antenna presented a good impedance match to its transmission line, because of the law of reciprocity, an antenna that transmits well also receives well. So externally, you could be measuring what's called radar cross-section of your antenna. If you are measuring the radar cross-section of an antenna that was well terminated on its transmission line, and then you put a short circuit on that transmission line, when you externally measured radar cross-section, the amount of echo of a free space signal sent to that antenna, you would see a change in the magnitude of the reflected signal from that antenna, which would be called radar cross-section. So I didn't say it's easy, but in theory you could do that externally. Is that what you're looking for, Wes, N2XJN, K2RIW?
Yes, I do. The problem that I have is, let's say I have a 6 feet tall Tesla coil, that's the secondary of Tesla coil, and the primary coil is only 2 inches tall. And when I swipe the LED outside of it vertically, there is a node at a certain point when there is no light and there is a light. But because Tesla coil is fitted with spectrum of frequency, not one frequency, then my question is, how valuable is this diode to me, or how valuable is that indicator because of impedance match, let's say, and switching?
The light-emitting diode you just mentioned, is that light-emitting diode operating at an optical frequency? And I thought you were trying to measure the RF characteristics of your Tesla coil. And there's a lot of octaves of difference in frequency here between a usual light-emitting diode and an RF test at, say, 1 gigahertz. So I'm a little confused here what you're doing with the so-called swiping with the light-emitting diode. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, when I emit, when I place on the stick a light-emitting diode LED, right, in theory, it is DC because it's a diode, and when it lights up, I'm getting any signal at any frequency, and what is important for the diode is that at this particular point there is energy density of such. Is it true? Or is it somehow, it depends from the impedance match of that circuitry that I'm doing. So let's say I have a 10 feet long or 8 feet long Tesla coil, and I'm just moving that LED in vicinity of it up, down, and see how intensity of that light into a sphere.
What's not clear to me now is that maybe you're using a light-emitting diode as part of a RF probe sensor. One of the things that we built at Symbol Technology, we had a 915 megahertz dipole on a printed circuit board, and at the center of the dipole we mounted a very sensitive light emitting diode. When we exposed that radiometer, I'm going to call it, or field probe, to a signal at 914 megahertz, the light emitting diode would light up, and by holding it in various positions, we could find out what the local 915 megacycle radio field was like. I don't think that's what you're doing, so I'm not quite sure what the light emitting diode is doing near a Tesla coil. The tie-in here is, I haven't heard the words that are drawing a picture for me yet. Over to you, Wes.
That's exactly what you think. When we put that radiometer in the vicinity of the antenna, that could be, let's say, a dipole antenna or a Tesla coil, whatever it is, we see a variation of the intensity of the energy by looking at the light coming out of the diode. My question is it good indicator or it's fooling me around? Because Tesla coil doesn't use one frequency, it uses spectrum of frequency where in hundreds of them you have a peak and then you have value from the left-hand side and value from the right-hand side. And the frequencies of Tesla coil signal is from 0 to 1 gigahertz with one particle peak at, let's say, 200 megahertz or 200 kilohertz, whatever.
Many Tesla coils have the equivalent of a spark gap generator, which is periodically pulsing the primary coil of the Tesla coil, and the ringing of the secondary coil and the voltage buildup because of the turns ratios is what's giving you the great big spark off the top of the tall secondary coil. And yes, if you looked at that with a spectrum analyzer, if you were pulsing it at a 1 kilohertz rate, you would see the proper setting of a spectrum analyzer, you would see 1 kilohertz sideband, but very broadband, noisy like rings. And so your radiometer is responding to some rather specific frequencies, depending on the length of its dipole going to that light emitting diode. Let me drop. So that is a radiometer. If you're trying to measure the antenna pattern at some particular RF frequency coming out of the Tesla coil, I think you would do a much better job of choosing a frequency that you care about, setting your spectrum analyzer to that frequency, with a cable going to a sniffer loop antenna, hold that loop antenna near various portions of your Tesla coil to find out how much amplitude you're getting at what polarity as you change the orientation of that loop antenna, and watch the display on the spectrum analyzer. I think you'd get more quantitative data in that manner. To get quantitative data out of the light emitting diode, I think is difficult. Not impossible, but difficult. Over to you, Wes.
Thank you very much for that answer. All I'm trying to do is find the way to see the antenna pattern when we're not dealing with single frequency, but we're dealing with a spectrum of frequency with the particle peak at somewhere, but very, very wide one, and see how the energy spread from the very top of the Tesla coil of the antenna to the very bottom, to the ground. Your advice is very much helpful. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck with that experiment. Let us know how it goes. Time for us to go over to the science talk. And one of the things, one of the many subjects that Roy is going to talk about tonight is what Mr. Pence has said recently. Roughly 1961, at a particular college commencement, I think it was, Mr. John F. Kennedy in 1961 said that, I've checked with our are physicists and are scientists, and we have the ability to develop the hardware to send a man to the moon and bring him safely back to Earth. And we're going to do that in the next decade. So he was making that pronouncement somewhere around 1961, and he wanted that to take place by 1969. A very famous statement. And the Apollo program and the Mercury program and the Gemini program helped us develop a lot of hardware and did this very exciting experiment where Neil Armstrong was the first of 12 astronauts that set foot on the moon. Let me drop this. So Kennedy became very famous for that statement and what followed. All of the buildup of all of that hardware and all of that science. Some number of years downrange, another president said, we're going to send somebody to Mars. That was crazy. But Mr. Pence now recently said, our Vice President Pence, said that by the year 2024, in the next 5 years, we're going to put a permanent installation on the moon. I'm convinced he is very wrong. First of all, it would be an extremely expensive procedure to do that. Second of all, you cannot put a permanent installation by normal means on the surface of the moon, because the moon has such an extremely long day and extremely long night. It's got a 28-hour period to it, a 28-day period. Let me drop. During the day, the temperature on the surface of the moon goes to something like 150 degrees centigrade. That's something like 300 degrees Fahrenheit. The best insulation in the world is not going to protect you from that. You're going to cook your astronauts. That's at high noon on the moon. And at nighttime on the moon, it goes to temperatures like minus 100 or 150 degrees centigrade. And the best insulation in the world is not going to keep you from freezing the astronauts. So, if you were establishing by some magic a resident on the moon that's, let me pick a number, 50 meters below the surface where the temperature is more constant in a cave, you stand a chance. On the surface of the moon, a colony, there is no technician, there is no technology I know of that could keep you from cooking and freezing your astronauts on the very first lunar day. So if you could afford to put astronauts on the moon and you think you're establishing a permanent installation, what in the world are you going to get in as payback for your, let me drop this. What in the world are you going to get for your payback on your huge investment? It's going to take the investment of multiple nations to do it. And second of all, the astronauts went to the moon on very specific days and never more than a couple of days of duration, on very specific location, on very specific lunar days, so to say, halfway between sunrise and sunset, where the temperature on the moon surface was tolerable for that brief couple of days. Leave an astronaut there for any longer period of time, and he's not going to survive, even if he's got enough food and water and air. So, I think Mr. Pence is very naive in his pronouncement on a number of levels. That's my first impression on that particular one of many subjects that Roy is about to discuss. AC2GS with Science Talk, and you guys, one of these days you got to send him some mailbag questions. AC2GS, K2IW, go ahead, Roy. And by the way, when Roy does give you any puzzles, if he does, try to give him participation. You got it, Roy.
Okay, very good, Dick. Hello to everyone, and as always, if you have any topics, if you have any questions, if you have any reputations of what I suggest, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. All the material that I cover, hopefully, will have links, and I even put up a link that Lou NY2H gave me for a piece from a previous conversation Dick had on the subject. So that'll all be on roy.ac2gs.com. And in addition, we maintain a chat room, and the easiest way to get there is chat.ac2gs.com, and it'll put you right there. I'm going to reorder my stories a little bit so that they make a little bit sense, but they push good old Vice President Pence closer to the top of the stack. So I'll let it drop for a second, and then I'll go on with the show. Okay, it's curious how some countries show their spacefaring prowess. In a surprise televised address to the nation, the Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced India's first successful test of an anti-satellite weapon, which the government used to destroy its own satellite. Modi said the test signified India as a space power, but critics claimed it's a regrettable and reckless step towards the ongoing weaponization of space. Quote, our scientists shot down a live satellite 300 kilometers, that's 185 miles to you guys, away in space in low Earth orbit, declared Modi in his address, as relayed by Reuters. India has made an unprecedented achievement today. India registered its name as a space power, end quote. India is now the fourth country to have tested an anti-satellite weapon, being the United States, Russia, and China. As the 1967 UN Outer Space Treaty, to which more than 100 countries have, are bound to, forbids the use of weapons of mass destruction in space, but no provision exists against the use of conventional weapons to disable or jam satellites in orbit. That said, the Council on Foreign Relations believes anti-satellite missile tests are arguably in technical violation of this treaty. Let me drop for a second. India's three-minute test called Mission Shakti was initiated by an island. It was initiated from an island near the country's east coast, the foreign ministry said in a statement. The test was done at a low altitude to ensure the resulting debris would decay and fall back onto the earth within weeks, wrote the ministry, and not remain in space where it would damage other equipment in orbit. Satellite tracker Marco Lugbro claims that the anti-satellite missile was launched from Abdul Kalam Island, with the likely target being MicroSat-R, which was operational at the time. The test happened at around 5:40 Zulu time last Wednesday. In a tweet, Professor Hugh Lewis, head of the Astronautic Research Group at the University of Southampton, said, "This is not the act of a responsible space nation. I expect swift and strong condemnation will follow." This incident is reminiscent of a notorious test conducted in 2007 in which China similarly destroyed its own satellite, spawning a huge debris field consisting of hundreds of objects. Both the United States and the former Soviet Union conducted anti-satellite tests from the 1950s through the 1970s. Let me drop for a second. India's test was, quote, a highly complex one, conducted at extremely high speed with remarkable precision, end quote, the Prime Minister said in a tweet. Quote, it shows the remarkable dexterity of India's outstanding scientists and the success of our space program, end quote, to which he also added, quote, it will make India stronger, even secure, and will further peace and harmony, end quote. The foreign ministry says that space must be used only for peaceful purposes and that India is against the weaponization of outer space and supports international efforts to reinforce the safety and security of space-based assets. That's some exceptionally flowery language for what was clearly an unabashed display of saber rattling and a conspicuous demonstration of India's newfound capacity to work and apparently fight in space. Indeed, India's space program has been chugging along nicely over the past several years. The country now offers affordable launch solutions. India sent a spacecraft to Mars in 2014, and it's hoping to send its own astronauts to space by 2022. Let me drop for a sec. The timing of last week's announcement is questionable, given that Modi is currently in the midst of an election campaign and the recent tensions between India and Pakistan. Modi's critics claim the Prime Minister is deliberately and possibly illegally trying to swing votes. Also, the test occurred as the group of government experts met in Geneva to discuss the prevention of arms races in outer space. India's action can be construed as a kind of slap in the face for that. India was already a space power before this test, claims Jessica West, a program officer at Project Plowshares and the managing editor of its Space Security Index. She finds it concerning that the nation needed weapons to test to further consolidate this standing. She went on to say, quote, there are other ways that this capability could have been demonstrated that would have caused less harm and been less aggressive, such as a flyby test. There's nothing defensive about an anti-satellite test. They are inherently offensive, and such destructive capabilities does little to enhance national security in outer space. Instead, we need to be focusing on enhancing common security within the globe and highly sensitive domains. Let me drop for a second. The test was described as reckless and adding fuel to an already simmering arms race in outer space at a time when states are meeting in Geneva Gus possible approaches to restraining the use and deployment of weapons in space. Stands in stark contrast to India's position on arms control and the beasts of space. People voiced concerns about the resulting debris fields, which were described as environmental hazards, that even if short-lived will put other spacecraft at risk. It is a side effect of the increasing great power rivalry in Asia between China and India. Some critics voiced the opinion that there was a chance in the early 2000s to head this off, but instead U.S. rhetoric about military control of space fanned the flames and encouraged China and other states to accelerate rather than hold off on their space weapon efforts. Now, we may be looking at a new space arms race. Despite the howls of protest garnered by the India test, it's doubtful anything meaningful will be done in the near term to curb the ongoing weaponization of space. Complaints by the U.S., Russia, and China would be quite hypocritical given their capacity to do the same thing, at the same time exhibiting an unwillingness to relinquish such power to themselves. It appears that as more nations venture into space, we will have to grudgingly accept this as being the new normal. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, no comment. On to the next one, which Dick mentioned. Surprisingly, there was no similar Space Force saber-rattling from the executive office this week here in the good old U.S. of A. Instead, Vice President Pence thought he should aim our sights on landing a man on the moon. Not because it was hard, but since we had already done it already, and 50 years ago, it was relatively easy, I guess. Speaking on behalf of President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence directed NASA to put American astronauts on the moon within the next 5 years at the fifth meeting of the National Space Council that was last Tuesday. Pence declared that current estimates, which say American astronauts would not walk on the moon until 2028, were not good enough. In language echoing Cold War sentiment, he said that we, once again, are in a space race against our adversaries, Russia and China. President Trump issued the Space Policy Directive 1 calling upon NASA to turn astronauts to the moon in December 2017. Frustrated with the lack of concrete plan as well as budget overruns and delays from the Space Launch System, Pence announced that NASA should attempt to reach the moon by any means necessary, even if it means using rockets and landers built by private companies. Let me drop for a second. Pence cited a few reasons to go to the moon, though the largest is essentially because Americans should be the best, and China has successfully launched its Chang'e series of missions, including its lander to the moon's far side. He also cited findings of water trapped in the moon's permanently shaded polar craters. By the way, as we all know, hopefully a human last walked on the moon in 1972. Let's be clear, quote, this is a great one, quote, let me be clear, the first woman and the next man on the moon will both be American astronauts launched by American rockets from American soil, end quote, Pence said. Pence chaired the fifth meeting of the National Space Council, a group of reinstated in 2017 by Trump. The council unites the interests of groups working on commercial, scientific, and national security space operations from a policy perspective. It's important to note that returning to the moon will be expensive. One estimate suggests $104 billion in 2005, or almost $135 billion in today's money. Estimates calculate that the Apollo mission cost $120 billion in today's dollars. Congress appropriated NASA $21.5 billion, more than its $19.9 billion asked in 2019. The president's proposed NASA budget includes cuts to scientific programs like WFIRST telescope and NASA's Office of STEM Engagement, but does offer over $300 million in funding for developing a lunar lander. The question stands as to what this will mean for the future of NASA and what else will be defunded in order to return humans to the moon. As Pence said, should things prove difficult, the president plans to change the organization, not the mission.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I got to the end of it. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Once again, this is AC2GX.
WB2GX,
AC1SAM.
Okay, Rich first, then Sam.
B2GS, WB2GX. We should train Donald Trump and Mike Pence to be the first two new astronauts on the moon. We should send them in a spacecraft with a very small motor. WB2GXM.
Okay, I don't want to make any kind of political statement. I just give you guys the facts. You deal with them as you wish. Sam, you wanted to say something?
This topic kind of borders on what we're not supposed to do. It seemed more political than scientific to me. Am I incorrect in that?
Second for the comment. Look, it's an opinion. You have a right to your opinion. I have a right to my opinion. Someone wanted to give their opinion?
A question. Can I ask about temperature?
Second of all, this ain't the place for it. In that, since you are staying out.
Yeah, we've always avoided political opinions on here.
Give you a political opinion, I call the political statement.
Use the word opinion first, a few seconds ago.
No, the opinion is that I don't think it was an opinion, not the news story. The news story is a news story. If you don't like the news story, I'm sorry you don't like the news story. Maybe you'll like another news story.
Can I ask the question how possible it is?
Sure, Gwen.
Yeah, the temperature around the equator seems to be quite friendly. Minus 24 Celsius, 23 Celsius, when you bury yourself not that deep in the ground. So, whatever Penn says, or whoever says, how possible it is.
I think you're assuming that this is from some committee that met and discussed this for a long, long time. The way that the news story was presented was that this was just a great idea that Vice President Pence had to make it, so he made it. There's no real study behind it. There's no NASA program that's ready to be budgeted for it. And this is all kind of at the top of someone thought it was a good idea at the time. Exactly the nature of this, other than a manned landing, is very vague. There's no real real plan documented any place. It's based on basically a speech. So is it possible? I guess if you throw enough money. Is it worth the trouble? Probably not. I don't exactly know what the bragging rights for landing on the moon having done it 50 years earlier. But again, that would be an opinion. And I don't want to engage in that here.
WS1.
Yes, Paul.
NASA has been talking about a plan B to get their Orion spacecraft to the moon. The first flight would be around the moon and not even landing on the moon, just around it, bring it back. They have a plan on using the SLS, the Space Launch System, which is unfortunately way behind schedule. But they're moving along. It's just taking a lot of time. The plan is to take this massive rocket with four liquid-powered engines, hydrogen and oxygen engines, and then two solid boosters similar to what was on the space shuttle, and launch the Orion around the moon unmanned first. That's the plan, and then eventually you would have a manned mission again around the moon and back. Let me drop it. So Bridenstine, who's the NASA administrator, has been talking to the contractors, and they're looking for a plan B. What they're thinking about doing, and it doesn't sound possible, is they would like to take two Delta four heavy rockets. Delta four heavy rockets are NASA's biggest rockets right now, and launch first the. They've done that actually before. They took an Orion spacecraft back in 2014 and launched it on the Delta IV rocket without the service module, just the aircraft itself, and went 3,000 miles out and it came back to test the heat shield. But their plan is, to get out to the moon, you need to send a service module. The service module is being built by the European Space Agency right now, which is about as big, actually bigger than the Orion spacecraft itself. That goes on the back of the Orion. Let me drop it. So his plan B is to take two Delta IV rockets, heavy rockets. So it's actually three Delta IVs bolted together as a heavy. And another set, same thing. Launch the service module up there into orbit, and then launch the spacecraft, and then somehow dock these two together. It's never been planned on docking these two together. It's supposed to go up in one piece because the capsule has the heat shield on it, and that attaches to the service module. That's always supposed to stay together from launch all the way until it comes back to Earth, and then it separates right before the capsule enters the Earth. Similar to what they did, with the Apollo mission. The problem is you can't send these two pieces up, and it has never been meant to dock. Connect all the power lines. The service module supplies the command module with oxygen and water and electricity. Let me drop it. You would have to somehow back the crewed vehicle into the service module, dock it, connect all these lines, and then fly to the moon and then fly back, and then eventually separate from the service module. The other problem is you'd be sending a crew up in this battery-powered spacecraft, essentially, because the power is supposed to be getting, they're supposed to be getting that from the service module, which is going to have these big solar panels on it. And so you got a crew sticking their neck out in this battery-powered spacecraft trying to dock with the service module to essentially get power and everything else up. I don't think they've thought it out. Maybe they just wanted to make a speech. But that they did. It did make the news. Back to you, Roy, WS2N.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. NASA's always had this kind of two-pronged problem. Part of them is a public relations organization that wants to get the population excited and on their side, and the other is the scientific exploratory, which is much more boring, and a bunch of engineers scrolling esoteric equations and such. And sometimes the two of those groups of people in NASA kind of collide head on. as probably what was going on here. I wish them all great luck and good fortune, and I always like to hear about new research being funded. NASA is an excellent organization of brilliant inventive men and women, and I only hope that we continue to budget them sufficiently to allow them to show their stuff to everyone. Anyway, we did the stories a little early. There is a puzzler, and I thought I would throw it out to the audience, see if anyone wants to play, and this might be one of the shortest puzzles in the world, or it might be a little bit longer. It depends upon how much...